This is the second day of this December 2008 four-day session, and I will resume reading from our text from yesterday, a book called Zibo, The Last Great Zen Master of China, translated by J.C. Cleary. He's a 16th century Chan master who's credited with having a leading role in the revival of Buddhism in China. Yesterday we read extracts from his biography. One point that is especially interesting that I didn't read was that he seemed to have had no Dharma transmission. In his biography's, his biographer's eulogy, that's Han Shan's eulogy, he says, because he had no lineage of teachers before him, Zibo never dared to promote himself falsely. And then the final paragraph of the biography says, living in a period when many phony Zen teachers made much of their supposed affiliation to lineages reaching back to the famous enlightened ones of old, Zibo never spoke about his lineage. Where did Zibo find his teachers? And then there's a verse, seems to be an answer to that. The precious ground, the empty forest, how many fallen leaves? Our former teachers' spirit bones are in the flooding waves. So now into his teachings, a record of his teachings. Let's start on with this section. When the sharp sword comes out of its case, the rays of light flash in the sun. It cuts through iron as if it were clay. Whatever kind of wood is cut and carved by it is sure to become a vessel. This is good use of the sword. Sword here, of course, would be mind, our innately enlightened mind of wisdom. When he says, whatever kind of wood is cut and carved by it is sure to become a vessel, this is probably he's referring to a teacher-student working together and the student becoming himself or herself a vessel of the Dharma. He goes on, though the sword is sharp, there's a certain kind of fool who only uses it to cut mud. No vessel is formed of the mud, and the sword blade is progressively ruined. This is bad use of the sword. So using our discriminating wisdom or misusing our discriminating wisdom. Misusing our mind. He goes on, this is like the basic subtle wonder inherent in the minds of living beings. They do not use concentration and wisdom to contemplate it, but just indulge in clinging to objects, running after sensory experience without turning back, flowing on through birth and death, illusion and suffering ever deeper with no escape. How could this be good use of mind? Well, another good use of mind would be anyone hearing this to recognize it as one's own tendencies. But just indulge in clinging to objects. Objects primarily meaning mental objects, thoughts. Running after sensory experience without turning back, grasping at this kind of pleasure or that kind of pleasure, always going for comfort, rejecting anything painful, we've never had, probably in the history of our species, we've never had so many different ways to misuse our minds. Can spend all of our waking hours frittering away our time in this endless surfing of information, any of the many places that it's available now, drowning in media, he goes on, those of sharp faculties and superior wisdom use the light of the mind's inherent nature to shine through sense faculties and sense objects to reveal that both lack reality nature. When the work of concentration and wisdom is achieved, right within sensory affliction they find liberation. Right within emotional consciousness they reach the light of wisdom. How does this come about? How do we manage this? Well, through doing Zazen regularly, every day, as much as we can. Then it happens on its own. We don't set about with a strategy or tactics for how to do this. The mind naturally acquires a simplicity and at the same time a clarity that enables us to use it as it was designed to be used, and not just to sift through data and images. When it says, refers to sense faculties and sense objects as lacking reality nature, it just means that there is no substance to these things, that this world of sense perceptions is a world without substance to it. It's a world in flux, and as such, it has no substantial reality to it. He goes on, if you use the sword like this, you are bound to cut through diamonds and jade. All the vessels formed will be strong, complete and imperishable, filled with sweet dew to offer libations to all. Whoever is touched by a drop will have his burning vexations become pure and cool. He will find immeasurable hundreds of thousands of samadhis. None comes from outside because all are inherent in the nature of mind. Thus it is said, For one who makes good use of mind, the 84,000 afflictions are 84,000 samadhis. For one who makes bad use of mind, the 84,000 samadhis are 84,000 afflictions. And then he says, ah, the sword is basically no different. With good use, every cut is accomplished. With bad use, day by day, the sword goes to ruin. The Bodhisattva of Wisdom, Manjushri, is often shown wielding a sword, the delusion-cutting sword of wisdom. And in our zazen, we have this sword right in our hands at all times. And what we have to do is cut. When we notice that our mind is drifting off, just cut it off. Turning our mind, redirecting our attention to the practice. The great Japanese Zen master Basui said, cut, 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 cut. Superb description of zazen. There is true light and there is false light. The true shines through 10,000 ages without relativity. The false is the light emitted when glued to the six sense objects. So the five that we commonly refer to as sense objects, that is sights, sounds, smells, tastes, and feelings, and then the sixth, in Buddhism, the sixth is thoughts. The thinking is considered one of the another sense, a sixth sense. And Zen addresses this attachment to the six senses as resting on or pivoting on the attachment to thoughts. If we can free ourselves from our attachment to thoughts, it doesn't mean never thinking. We do need to think sometimes. But if we can refrain from dwelling in thoughts unnecessarily, then we will find ourselves detached from the other five senses as well. Detached doesn't mean dead to them, but free to take them or leave them, to respond or not respond. Here's another part. Zibo says, even an utter fool would fear being burned or scalded if we sent him into boiling water or fire. Even under compulsion, he would not agree to go into boiling water or fire. The boiling water and fire of the five desires burn and scald the life of wisdom of the body of reality of living beings. Yet people willingly walk into them, and not for a morning or an evening only. To the end, they never fear them. Have they lost their minds or gone mad? We pause and cite what these five desires are. There are a couple ways of understanding them. This footnote tells us they can be construed as desires for the five sense objects, what we were just talking about, or And this is quite common, this interpretation. The five desires are desires for wealth, sexual pleasure, food and drink, fame, and sleep. I love that. They get them all, don't they? All the big ones. Wealth, sexual pleasure, food and drink, fame, and sleep. Back to the text. To the end, they never fear them. Have they lost their minds or gone mad? Overall, they judge the stinking bag of skin. That was an old way of referring, old phrase they used in Chinese Buddhism. Overall, they judge the stinking bag of skin to be a vessel of purity and judge the mind of ignorance to be the root of life. It's because they cannot contemplate the body in terms of the four elements or the mind in terms of the four clusters. The four elements are fire, earth, air, and water. It's just an ancient way of understanding physical phenomena. And the four clusters are the skandhas, other than the first skandha, form. We recite these, chant these every time we're doing the Prajnaparamita. Modern people cannot sleep if the pillow is the least bit uncomfortable. When they lie down in bed, they are sure to make it comfortable before it will do. Birth and death is indeed important to people, yet they all ostensibly rest content and unconcerned and don't plan for it in the least. Why? Well, as with so many other of his predecessors and other masters, he's trying to shake us out of our slumber. He's trying, and they are trying to wake us up so that we can use this precious human body, mind, this life to advance our work toward freedom and ultimately to experience awakening itself. It doesn't take a terribly thoughtful person to understand that most human beings waste a lot of time in the ways that he mentions here. We waste a lot of time. The Buddha put it in big broad strokes when he said human beings are caught between their desires and their aversions. We are constantly trying to avoid that which we dislike and to grasp and hold on to that which we like. There it is. Back and forth. The affirming faith in mind that we chant every day, affirming faith in mind says very much the same thing in different words, starting off with the great way is not difficult for those who do not pick and choose. When preferences are cast aside, the way stands clear and undisguised. But we are so habituated to ordering our life in terms of grasping at what we want and avoiding what we don't want. It's a deeply, deeply ingrained conditioning. But so long as we live this way, then we are missing the very essence of life. Yes, we may manage to a degree, we may manage to avoid what we don't want and get what we want, but then in the end, certainly, it can't come out the way we want. Here's another part. The Dharma is indescribable. If it could be described, the Dharma too would be a description. The sages know that the Dharma is indescribable and that all kinds of descriptions, metaphors, and comparisons for it are no more than temporary expedients. If it is compared, that is the Dharma, if it is compared to emptiness, though emptiness is boundless, it cannot bring forth all things. If it is compared to the earth, though the earth can bring forth things, it has boundaries. If it is compared to water, though water can flow through things, it can dry up. If it is compared to the wind, though the wind can move the many things, it can die down. If it is compared to fire, though fire light can banish the darkness, it cannot be touched. If it is compared to a tree, though a tree can produce all kinds of flowers and fruits, detached from the ground, it has no place to put its roots. If it is compared to a lotus, though the lotus has flowers and fruits at the same time, apart from water, it cannot exist. So he's mentioning some of the most common metaphors and similes for the Dharma. These you find in Buddhist texts that go way back. If it is compared to the kampa flower, though the kampa is fragrant, when the autumn wind comes, the fragrance disappears. If it is compared to jewels, though they are the most singular gems in the world, they do not equal the clear emptiness and pervading luminescence of the Dharma. The Dharma has been likened to a dragon, to a lion, to a great person, to a king, to a father, to a mother. It has been described as great, as small, as long, as broad, as square, as round, as curved, as straight. It has been compared to motion, to stillness, to curling up, to extending out, to the relative, to the absolute. In essence, despite the hundreds and thousands of metaphors, the Dharma is indescribable. Therefore, I say that descriptions, metaphors, and comparisons are nothing but the temporary expedient methods of the sages as they have responded to beings. For this reason, those who cling to the metaphors are stumped by the Dharma. They do not know the Dharma. We are always so ready to cling to images and thoughts about anything, people, anything. And the same goes for our tendencies around this matter of the Dharma. And as we mentioned yesterday, a big job of a teacher is to try to strip the students of these clinging to things, to images and words and concepts. Same same goes, for, of course, for mu. It is so... We can't... It's inconceivable, ultimately. And yet, how do we get a hold of the inconceivable, the formless? We can't picture or conceive of the formless. And so, very often when we think that we are concentrating on mu or any other koan, it's not that, but it's we're seeing it through the veils of our concepts and images. This next one, he talks about light. When the light of the eyes shines on objects, at first there is no hate or love, no aversion or desire. It does not shine on sandalwood any more than shit. This is called the everywhere equal light. For the Buddhas and ancestral teachers, through joy and anger, through sadness and happiness, there is nowhere they go that is not this fundamental, everywhere equal light. For ordinary people, amidst the clouds of affliction, it may show through for a time, but the force of habitual behavior is strong, and it is immediately covered over again. So we know this from sitting. If we've been at this long enough, we know that there are times when clouds part and we see things as they are, however briefly. And this is most commonly happens in sesshin, where after we have been doing a lot of sitting, hours and day after day, that we can look at the most ordinary thing, something we've looked at thousands of times, and it's new. You can look at our hand, the palm of our hand, or the back of the hand, and that hand is one that we've never seen before. A tree, a flower, a way that light falls on the wall. A little of this, a corner, anything. This is what it means to see something as it is, rather than through this film of conceptualization, the notions about things, and not, of course, not just things, but people. This is seeing everything just as just equal. There's no judgment. There's not this is better than that, or this person is better than that person. It's everything is just brimming with this self nature, this purity. There's this great vast world out there. When we can get beyond our stubborn judgments and evaluations and notions. there's this, what comes to mind is this old painting from, I think, the Middle Ages. It shows someone peering out beyond a sphere of the it's meant to be the globe or the sphere of the earth, and looking out beyond that. He continues, thus those who are good at progressing on the path are able, when this light appears for a moment amidst hard to control junctures of good and evil, to set their eyes on it and see into it. They are not turned around by habitual behaviors. These are called brave heroes. If the energy falters, the clouds of ignorance abruptly close in. Energy. Energy can be understood as awareness. Energy doesn't mean straining, doesn't mean rushing. The purest form of energy is just clear awareness, presence of mind, being in touch with this now. And it takes energy to rest in that energy. It takes the energy of discarding, interfering thought forms. And returning to the practice. But as we go on in practice, or even in one session, as we go on, we find the energy, more energy becomes available to us. It's a snowballing effect, where the more seconds or minutes that we spend absorbed in the practice and not involved in our thoughts, the more energy we have to continue doing that. And then it just builds, either in a session or over many years of practice. But it doesn't come easily, because we have been for so long giving way to thoughts that we have to really work to not do that. Another section here. There are three levels of quiet sitting: low-grade sitting, equanimous sitting, and sitting to add power. Low-grade sitting is only being able to keep the tongue pressed to the roof of the mouth, the teeth firmly closed, both hands clasped with the arms at the sides, spine erect and vertical without leaning to one side. So, in other words, you're sitting, you got the posture down, basically. You, from the outside, you've got the form. It takes the power of faith as its leading principle. The best ones have the compassionate protection of a strict teacher. The lesser ones have the help of their companions in the Dharma. This is called low-grade sitting, or sitting at a kind of a maintenance level. This kind of sitting, I might add, is not likely to lead one to awakening, although it's certainly possible. Awakening, awakening can happen even if you have never even heard of sitting. It's kind of a sitting as a kind of a relaxation practice, just clearing the mind, settling down, settling the mind, and finding some relief from stress. And then he goes to the second one. Equanimous sitting initially takes as its leading principle to see through the three sets of elements, sense organs, sense objects, and sense consciousness, to penetrate through these three sets of elements totally from beginning to end until there is no doubt. And then he describes this. This is something that is not part of our Japanese, certainly not Japanese Zen. It's nothing I've done. But he describes it. When you are about to sit, you view your body as clouds and shadows and your mind as wind in a net. There is no other special technique. If you can be firm and strong, oblivion and scattering and painful stimuli are naturally peeled off. You may sit straight through half a day or two or three days without eating or drinking, and your energy is as before. This is called equanimous sitting. Sitting to add power takes penetrating through to fundamental mind as its task. You may use the enlightenment stories of the ancient worthies, referring mainly to koans, to shut off mental machinations and stimuli, naturally fusing into an unchanging state. It's like carrying a mortal enemy. Without your wishing it, oppressive anger blocks off space. You persist like this until all at once the cliches of environment and person, of holy and ordinary, are totally overthrown. Let's just pause here. This thing about carrying a mortal enemy, without your wishing it, oppressive anger blocks off space. There is this analogy that was used in Chinese Zen of when you get to a state of intense practice, they call it sometimes great angry determination. And the point is, it becomes consuming, this work on a koan. It takes over the mind. And then this reference, the cliches of environment and person, of holy or ordinary. Another word besides cliches would be the notions or concepts about self and other, about enlightened and unenlightened, about ordinary life and enlightened life, or inside and outside, are totally overthrown. It's because all these are concepts. They're concepts. With this kind of willpower, energy, and strength, you wear out the meditation cushion. In a few minutes, you cross over an eon, but without the thought of traversing an eon. At this moment, oblivion and scattering have no place to come to rest. All of time and space as a whole are a single meditation point, extending endlessly before you, filling your eyes. Suddenly the mind ground bursts open, but you do not rejoice. Why? What you had before, you now encounter again. What is there that's special? This is called sitting to add power. There's this style of speaking and writing that we find in the Chinese texts where they seem to always want to get across what things are called. This is called da 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 da. This is called da 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 da. This is called da 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 da. I never quite got the point of all that. Emphasizing how to refer to things. This reference twice here to oblivion and scattering. These are kind of opposite tendencies that we can fall prey to in our sitting. They're obstacles in practice. So oblivion is where you can sit, and you can sit for a period of 10 minutes, 20 minutes, an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, and not account for it. This happens most commonly, I think, in a late night sitting, yaza, where a time can go by, you sit down, time goes by, you get up, you look at the clock, and an hour, 2 hours, or half an hour, whatever, has gone by, and you don't know, have a clue as to where you've been. You're just in a state of oblivion. You're not sleeping. And you're not wakeful. You're just not there. This is a real impediment in Zazen. And the other, scattering, I think, is more widely understood, just the mind being restless and not settling, just roaming from one thought or image or memory or idea to another. This, when the mind ground bursts open with awakening, what you had before, you now encounter again. What is there that's special? If there's any litmus test of genuine awakening, it is the extent to which you realize that you've gained nothing, that you have nothing, that everyone else doesn't also have, that enlightenment is our nature and is equally the nature of all beings. There is nothing special one has, much less what one has gained through awakening. It's just the way things are, the way people are, whole and complete, enlightened. No one more or less than anyone else. Our time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.